like a fish in a net. It was hope. As much as I badmouth people in general and think the worst of them, I'm secretly waiting for them to surprise me. Try as I might, I haven't been able to give up on them wholly. Even though they're 9 9/10 dirt, now and again they're capable of something angelic. I can't say that it restores my faith, because I really had none in the first place, but when it happens, it does confuse you. Still, my new friends weren't in any hurry to weigh me down with their hospitality. I couldn't help feeling that they wished I would disappear much as I'd arrived. I explained to them that I had 2 horses with me, that I'd been traveling for weeks, and I'd be grateful to water my animals and wash, if it wasn't putting them to any trouble. They weren't as quick to agree or as cordial as you might expect, and a number of doubtful glances passed between them before the man with the gun nodded, and the friendlier of the 2 woodcutters came with me while I fetched the animals. Then I waited beside the old man while the other 2 finished their job of cutting. He couldn't but have been curious about me, or at least where I'd come from, and I had plenty of questions I wanted to put to him, but each time I asked him something, he wandered off to poke his gun into the woods, as if at any minute he was expecting us to be surrounded. We didn't leave that place for another hour at least. The men loaded their sled with their logs and put themselves into harness to tow it. They were a somber bunch, hardly sharing a word with each other, and I wondered if they always talked this little, or if it was my being there that had made them so shy. I walked my horses so as to keep the men company, and finally one of the 2 in harness asked me what it was bringing me to New Judea. It had been so long since I'd heard anybody call it that it took me a second to figure out what he meant. It almost made me laugh to see these men barely perching on their piece of the world and still calling it by the old name. I told him his question put me in mind of the old story about the hunter who goes to stay with his friend in the woods and on the way he gets mauled by a bear. He shook his head at me to say the story rang no bells with him. Our little walk together was pretty short on entertainment, so I decided to tell them how it happens. The hunter's going back through the woods. It's winter, and the bear is what the Russians here used to call a shatun, which is to say a bear that's woken up out of his winter sleep because he couldn't lay down enough fat in summer on account of food being short, salmon not running, no berries, and so forth. Their eyes were all big and fixed on me now, and it felt like I was telling the story to children. The one in particular who'd asked me the question had a pair of blue eyes that were as round and trusting as a couple of open mouths. His face spurred me to pad the story out with details, because I liked the way he was drinking it all in. "Well," I said, "you can imagine there is nothing ornerier than a skinny, wakeful bear in February, with its fur hanging all baggy from starvation. What should this bear see but a juicy hunter making his way through the forest? Now the bear is drooling with hunger at the idea of eating this man, and it leaps out and takes a big bite of him. The hunter and the bear struggle for a while, but the bear is more hungry, more strong, and more desperate. Then, just as those big jaws are about to crush the hunter's head like a pine cone, he manages somehow to wriggle free and sprint away to freedom. Now you can picture for yourselves how battered and raggedy he is when he shows up at his friend's cabin. He's more or less alive, but the bear has taken a big chunk of his arm and scratched up his face with his claws. Add to which, he's dizzy with blood loss. So he's banging on the door in need of water and bandages to staunch the bleeding. Now his friend opens up, takes one look at him, and says in his gravely deadpan way, "I see you already met Flossie." Maybe I had just lost my knack of telling a story. I certainly hadn't had the opportunity to visit with anyone for any length of time lately. There was a silence after I stopped speaking that reminded me of the clang when the 2 of them put down the saw in the tree trunk. And then the man with the gun said, "It's bad for bears around here. Seems like the fewer of us there is, the more there is of them." And the man with the round blue eyes said nothing at all, but looked a little disappointed, as if he'd been expecting some other kind of story. I explained that I'd told them this because they'd called the place New Judea. They still looked at me puzzled. "I guess I'm saying," I said, "that when a thing is terrible and dangerous, a man needs to find a pretty name for it to let himself sleep a little easier at night." That didn't make it any plainer for them, and my spelling it out bled any drop of humor from the story altogether. "What do you call this place, then?" said the round-eyed man. I couldn't answer him. In my mind, I didn't give it a name at all. It wasn't like the Tungus, who had been there so long that all the places meant something to them. To me, it was just the city, the land, the snow, the sky, the bears. If it was any place, to me it was the far north. My father had an expression for a thing that turned out bad. He'd say it had gone west. But going west always sounded pretty good to me. After all, westwards is the path of the sun. And through as much history as I know of, people have moved west to settle and find freedom. But our world had gone north, truly gone north, and just how far north I was beginning to learn. Our way turned off the road and onto a narrow track through the forest. We'd been going for about 15 minutes. I said, "You gentlemen are awful choosy about the wood you cut." The man with the gun knew what I was getting at, so at least he wasn't simple. "We don't like to fell it too near the town. We live quiet, and we don't like to be bothered none." That made sense to me. I'd been lucky so far, but that road could bring you no end of trouble. We picked our way a little further through the forest, until finally we drew near to the place they called Horeb. It wasn't anything like I'd been expecting. They had put a lot of work into her, no doubt, but it wasn't a settlement our parents would have thought too highly of. The narrow path wound into a clearing about an acre square, and smack in the middle was a five-sided stockade with a gateway let into it. It must have enclosed about a quarter of an acre of land. I guess there were a number of buildings inside it, because there were separate plumes of smoke rising up. The men asked me to wait, and then disappeared inside with their logs. They were a long time coming out, and I could see eyes peering at me through chinks in the palings, so that I began to wonder if some kind of ambush was being set for me. It must have been close to 20 minutes that passed before the front gate was raised up, and out came half a dozen men, led by one in a long black robe, and what was stranger, beside him a woman of about my own age, who laid a basket at my feet that had some gray salt in it, and the smallest loaf of bread I had ever seen. It was a strange little welcoming party, and a couple of the faces in it were not exactly friendly. The man in black who led them stared at me with a holy look that made me want to giggle. He embraced me, and I stiffened in spite of myself, because I didn't like to be touched that way by a man, and I noticed that he had some kind of perfume on. "Welcome, brother," he said. "Our remnant. Remnant of a remnant." And before I could think of anything to reply to him, they were all on their knees, and he was leading them in a prayer of thanksgiving. I stood there feeling foolish, but knowing I'd feel more foolish if I joined them, so I snatched off my hat as a mark of respect and waited for them to finish. And now, instead of just feeling foolish, I felt foolish and my ears were beginning to freeze. When the prayer was over, they stood up again, and there was a pause as if they were expecting something from me. It reminded me that for all the hardships I put up with in my life, awkward silences weren't generally one of them. I looked at them all and recognized the faces of the three men I'd encountered in the forest, and they were all of them waiting for me to speak. I cleared my throat and told them my name and where I'd come from and thanked them for their kindness. They still seemed to want more, so I added that, though I had never heard of a settlement called Horeb until just this day, they were a credit to their folk. "Amen," said the perfumed man in black, and he took my arm to lead me in, nodding at the woman to gather up the bread and salt. "Brother," he said, "we can stable your horses with ours. But as a sign of peace, I ask you to surrender those guns you're carrying while you are our guest. He could see me hesitate. I'll vouch personally for them. What it was that made me trust him, I can't say for sure, but there was something about him that reminded me of one of my uncles. He must have been around 50. I could see that he wasn't all seriousness, and I liked the way he bossed them all without ever raising his voice. I unbuckled the belt and handed it to him, and we went inside. The settlement seemed bigger inside than out. It had a number of dwellings in the yard, and smaller shacks built right against the wall. There must have been 30 to 40 people there altogether, including children, at least one babe in arms and several barely old enough to walk. It had been a long time since I'd seen a child, at least a living one. Their eyes followed me as I followed my host across the yard to the largest of all the dwellings. They all looked well enough, if a little grubby and underfed. We shucked off our footwear and our outdoor clothes on the porch and went into a long, plain room that reminded me of the old meeting house at home, except it had a cross at one end and some Mary and child pictures, none of which they would have stood for where I came from. Reverend Bothwaite, which is what I came to know him as, invited me to sit with my legs under a low, round table that had a kettle of hot charcoals beneath it and a thick cotton cover, somewhat of an Asiatic style. 6 or 7 of us sat there, with our feet under the cloth warm enough over that brazier. The Reverend locked my guns in a box that he put back under the altar, and then he joined us. The man with a frost-pinched nose set down a battered urn and a dish of hard candy that looked like it was 10 years old. The Reverend poured out the tea and passed it around the table. "I won't pretend that these are good times for my flock," he said.
"No," I said, "but compared to elsewhere, you're thriving."
The enamel mug they gave me had been part cleaned at best and smelled of caribou stew.
"Are things bad in Evangeline?"
The men around the table stopped fighting over the candies and waited for me to say something.
"What things?" I said. "There's no one there."
I told him what he pretty nearly must have known himself. The years of calamity and migration as starving people came out of the South, the hungry and the desperate who came to prey on a people gone soft with compassion. I said how we'd belatedly designated a few of us constables and set us to keep the peace, but by then we were overrun.
In any case, the townsfolk themselves were among the worst of them. It turns out that goodness only lives when the times permit it.
Well, we allow more hope than that, Mr. Makepeace.
Esperanza's the same, I went on. I passed through on my way here. Homerton, too, I expect.
If that's where you're headed, I can save you a journey. All that you see here is what's left of the place.
I told him that I thought the name of this place was Horeb.
Or New Homerton, you could call it. His grin hadn't an ounce of humor in it. He rubbed his tired, unslept eyes. Looking round at all their dark, smoked meat faces, I thought how much they resembled Tungus. It was as though they'd come here with their European faces as blank as bars of white soap and had new Asiatic ones carved out of them by the cold and the wind.
"What happened to the city?"
Bothwaite shook his head. I felt such a weariness in him.
"Much like you said, rather late in the day we had to adopt a more muscular variant of our beliefs. We had to let go of a lot of things that were precious to us."
I tried to imagine my father saying it, but to him that would have been total defeat. In his mouth it would have meant, "We came here and lost everything." "Things have a life built into them," said Bothwaite. "You just never expect to be in at the end of anything. You never expect to be among the last."
Around him, the men nodded or sucked tea through their candy, rather untroubled, like children whose father was doing their fretting for them.
Bothwaite went on. "The great blessing is that, as our life becomes harder and simpler, I feel such closeness with my God."
The round-eyed man sucked up his tea in time to cap the Reverend's words with an Amen, which the others followed. Then the Reverend stood up and told me I was welcome to stay as long as I wanted. I felt light round my hips without my guns, like you do when you take off heavy boots after a long day walking. They gave me a bed in one of the shacks that belonged to a woman named Violet. He served me a dish of cold potatoes with a bit of fatty meat and watched over me while I ate it. The shack had a funky smell which put me off eating at first, but after a while, I got used to it. I thought it was just the two of us, but a cracked old voice suddenly called out from behind a sheet that cut off one corner of the shack.
"I'm dying," it said.
Violet lifted the sheet and went in behind it. "Shut up, mother," she said. "We've got a visitor, a young man," which was wrong on both counts. I went round the sheet out of politeness. A tiny, toothless old woman was sitting up in her sour bed linen. She looked like a bag of sticks.
"I'm dying,"
she cried out at me. Violet rolled her eyes at me and let the sheet drop back. "Don't mind her," she said. The bed she gave me was hers. No more than a cot slung just above the floor, and it creaked when I sank into it. Violet got into the bed with her mother, who kept it up all night, moaning and crying out. Violet woke me in the middle of the night when she got up to put a log on the stove. The stove door squeaked, and the light in the shack sat up a little as the log took. She didn't shut it immediately, but came and stood over me. I pretended to be asleep. The fire from the stove lit my eyelids orange. I could hear her breath sighing through her nostrils as she stood there a while, gazing down at me. Then I felt something like a tickle, and I realized she was touching my head. It was gentle, but I didn't feel altogether comfortable with it.
"What are you doing?" I said.
She didn't startle, but kept on. "What happened to your face?" she asked.
"Someone burned it," I said.
"You poor thing," she said. She stroked my head for a bit longer. Then she shut the door of the stove and padded back to bed with the old woman. I never feel sorry for myself, never. But that small tenderness upset me in a way I hadn't been for a long time. And I was awake for a while with thoughts of Ping and the baby roiling in my brain. And every hour, like a cuckoo clock, the old woman would cry out, "I'm dying!" in her high, cracked voice that seemed like it was speaking for all of us. Chapter 10. Look at it how you like. There was something strange about Horeb, and I wasn't minded to stay, but my horses got colicky in the night, and there was no chance of my leaving the next morning, or in the days that followed. I didn't much like bunking with Violet and her mother, either. Something about the heat and the fetid smell in their hut, and the old woman's crying, gave me bad dreams. One night it was women and babies tumbling out of one another in an endless squalling chain of red bodies, all linked up with their belly cords, like one of those families you might snip out of paper. But this one went on forever, and the babies were women themselves with babies of their own, so that if you stretched it all out, it would reach back to creation, and the first woman with her pinched monkey face who ever walked upright. You never expect to be in at the end of anything. That was what Bothwaite had said. Ping's child had been a girl, too, choked with her own belly cord as she lay wrong side up in her mother's womb. So that line perished with her. And as for my line, I was the last of it, and there would be no slippery little women dropping out of me. I thought life back home was hard scrabble, but Horeb was even worse, grubbing in the woods for ferns and burdock, thin, watery soups at mealtimes, and a taste of meat at most twice a week. The only thing they got to fill up on was religion. They had big helpings of church 3 times a day. Morning, lunchtime, and evening, they would troop into that building and have Bothwaite read or preach at them for up to an hour.
It struck me early on that if they prayed less, they'd eat better. But as a guest, I felt bound to keep my thoughts to myself. From the second day, I decided I'd give the sermons a miss and went off to the woods for a scout around. I'd not gone farther than 500 yards from the stockade when I came upon half a dozen wild caribou nosing through the forest, scratching up lichen to feed on. Both Wade still had my guns, so there was nothing I could do but watch. It was too much for me to take. All those fools sat in church with their bellies grumbling, and here there was breakfast, lunch, and dinner wandering about on four legs, just daring you to put it in your mouth. I ran back to the stockade. There was one man on guard at all times, and he let me in. I went straight to the little chapel and burst in breathless. I begged them to excuse my interruption. I told them about the caribou, and I said that if the Reverend would be willing to return one of my firearms, I'd put more than enough meat on the table to repay their hospitality to me. The Reverend's face hardened into a hatchet while I was speaking, and as soon as I had finished, he told the congregation that, just as many of them had not yet made the acquaintance of Cousin Makepeace, neither had Cousin Makepeace had the opportunity to acquaint himself with the customs of Horeb, in particular that the service of God came above all other works. The appetite for sanctity surpassed mere carnal appetite. If I'd been a little smarter, I would have stopped there. Everything was counseling me to bite my tongue. From the angry sparkle in Bothwaite's eye to the dumbstruck faces of his congregation. But living alone for so long had made me stubborn. I said I was sorry for bursting in so loud and unmannerly, and I would have never have done it in the ordinary way. I didn't mean that they should stop their praying or the Reverend should stop his preaching, but since I wasn't much of a churchgoer myself, I'd be happy to make myself useful to them. And I said that even Jesus let the disciples gather ears of corn on the Sabbath. So how about it? Could I have one of my guns? By now I saw that I'd made myself as unwelcome as a juggler at a funeral. The Reverend hissed at me that there would be no further discussion until the service was over. Then he turned his back on me and prayed in a loud voice for 10 minutes. Most of the congregation turned their faces with him, but one or two of the children stared at me and had to be cajoled into looking away again. I was so angry, I barely heard a word he said. My mind was fixed on the caribou snuffling away through the forest. I was hungry myself, of course, but I also thought of those pale, skinny children in the chapel, with their streams of yellow snot and dirt-streaked faces, and how much better off they would be with a plate of meat than a bellyful of words. They grumbled away in their prayers, and I stalked out furious. The Reverend didn't speak to me for the next couple of days. I mean, he greeted me when he saw me, but very cool and offish, and most of the others in Horeb followed his lead. It didn't bother me any. I had enough to do with nursing my horses, and when I wasn't doing that, I liked to be outside. Still, I never saw any more caribou, and that was a pity. Every time Violet came back from the chapel in her headscarf, her mother was too feeble to leave their shack, I asked her what the Reverend preached on. Most of the time he told them to keep close to Christ in these difficult moments, hold them like a match flame in their hearts, and other such bunkum. But he also warned them of false prophets and the dangers of a divided kingdom in ways that made me certain he didn't much like having a mutineer in his midst. Partly I was flattered to give him a text for his sermons, but I didn't mean to offend him, and I think we were both glad when my horses took a turn for the better and my thoughts began to shift to moving onwards. I went to him in his quarters a few days before I was set to leave. It was evening, an hour or so after his last service. He was writing by lamplight. The room was comfortable, and there was a plate of food on the table beside him. He put his pen down as I came in and closed the book. "Nice digs you've got, Reverend," I said, meaning to be friendly. "My flock are happy to see me comfortable," he said, as if I'd meant to put his back up a little. I told him I was getting ready to move on and wanted to provision myself for the journey. None of that came as much of a surprise to him. Then I said that I needed my guns back so that I could hunt before I left, and that out of gratitude to the people of Horeb, I hoped he would let me share whatever I took with them. The Reverend said there was a very strict ordinance on no weapons in the stockade, but he would hand over my guns when I rode out, on the understanding that I would put them back in his safe keeping when I returned. I told him that would be fine with me. Before I left, he asked me in a schoolmasterly way what had happened to my own impetus towards religion. As a child of settlers, I must have been brought up in the church. I said that, speaking personally, I couldn't find much in it. I said that religion made people soft with love or think they were better than other people. I said I'd read the Bible cover to cover and I thought it was a scam. It seemed obvious to me that the whole thing was cooked up by the Levites so the other tribes would feed them. That it was good stories, but there was tables of horseshit in it, the Urim and the Tumim. That no one was bigger sinners than the kings of the Old Testament.
Interesting, he murmured. Very interesting.
I said I apologized if my speaking plainly gave him offense, but that he would find me a straight-dealing person, and I'd come to collect my guns in the morning. As I turned to leave, he called me by my name.
Sometimes, he said, our imperative is survival. We are much reduced, but this community coheres. You are the last of your whole city. Ask yourself, by what grace did this settlement survive where yours and others collapsed?
I said I had always had the utmost faith in the power of dumb luck.
Yes, he said, perhaps. But walking back to Violet's shack in the twilight, I did think that maybe he had a point.
Boathwaite had kept his little flock together somehow, and even if Moses and Muhammad were charlatans, maybe that was better than inflicting the naked truth on people. We're all out here in the desert, and we're alone, and all of us will die. Even if it's true, maybe it's not the kindest or most practical thing to tell anyone. And lying in bed, listening to Violet's mother again,
I'm dying! I'm dying!
I thought, am I angry with Boathwaite because I want to believe him so much? Because I want to settle like a kitten in the crook of the Almighty's arm and surrender to his wisdom? That night I had another of those weird dreams again. This time it was about thousands of people on a quayside, embarking on a huge ship. For a while there were hordes of us at the dock, waiting to go on, and then there were much fewer, and suddenly it seemed that almost everyone was on board, apart from myself and a couple of stragglers, like some queer-looking animals that Noah had left behind, doomed, irrelevant, because we had arrived too late. The Rev was as good as his word about the guns. He walked me outside the stockade and handed them over before his morning service. I told him I'd be back in a day or so, depending on the hunting. We were never friendlier with each other than at the moment when we knew we'd be apart for a while. He was so pleased to be rid of me that he came over quite warm toward me. I can continue to respect a man while differing with him, he said. There's a lot of good feeling toward you here, Makepeace.
I thought he was referring to the gaggle of children who followed me around because I had gotten into the habit of giving food scraps to them, but he seemed to be talking about himself. Surely you won't miss me, Reverend? I said as I heaved up into the saddle.
He didn't reply, but he winked up into the light at me. His lips parted in a big, toothy smile, and I felt his eyes on me all the way into the forest. Chapter 11.
I am one of those who need motion. Sometimes my body barks at me like a dog that wants walking. I was always that way. My father would say the devil had got into my legs, the way they'd kick and fidget if I went to bed after an evening when I'd done nothing except sit and write homework. My mother said I was the same as a baby, always pedaling and wriggling and waving my arms. I think better when I'm moving. If only they'd let me pace in the classroom, I could have taken in a heap of science and learning. but after 20 minutes in my seat, my knees would be hopping up and down, battering my desk, spilling ink, getting me into trouble. Constabulary school was different. I was older. There were only a half dozen of us, and the time in the classroom didn't seem endless. We had to study so quick. And there was something exciting about it. Sitting in school felt obedient, but we were disobeying so much just by being there. There was still so much anger towards us, even from our own families. We were police. We were being trained to use violence. And our parents had come here because most of them were against the idea of using force, ever. My own family was too ashamed of what had happened to me to say anything about it, but of the others who were training with me, I knew how hard it was for them. Me, I was a cuckoo. I never belonged in that world. I mean, I believe in being good, but so many of those people were wedded to appearing good, like the Crashaws and the Stedmans, who had given up eating meat because it was ungodly. And because of my nature and my being a good shot, and because of everything that had happened to me, people in the city seemed pretty accepting of me. The man who trained us was called Bill Evans. He came out from Alaska and they gave him a classroom above the bank to teach us in. I loved Bill Evans. He was fat and crusty. He smoked and swore, and he had no patience with city and their anxiety about being true to their founding principles and the long arguments about what to call us. "Too few, too late," he said. "A little Quaker village at the end of the world. You don't need a police force, you need an army." Some families would have no truck with it. In spite of what was happening to their city, they preferred to move away. In spite of being robbed by hungry people. In spite of what happened to their daughters. We provoked hate from people who said they didn't believe in hate. Some would spit at us when we patrolled the town. The key was not to take it personal. They could feel the world they'd created slipping away, and we had become the symbol of it. The city was unsafe, and they blamed us, the hated lawmen. Now all that was ancient history. The towns were gone, and the people that preyed on them had moved elsewhere. The far north looked like it was me, and Horeb, and the scattered Tungus, and the ghost of a hope that tickled my chest with that piece of broken wing. When Noah sends the birds out onto the flooded earth, and one brings back a leaf, that was what the plain was to me. It meant we weren't forgotten. Someone else had survived the flood. Someone was beached on Ararat, and the waters were in retreat. Sometimes I couldn't help myself, and I built a life in my head, planning what this new world would be like. And that's when I felt I understood my father a little, because the world I wanted resembled the place he must have had in mind when he moved out to the far north. And I realized that it wasn't his fault. It was in the nature of the times. It was in the nature of the calamities that had struck our planet. People had all those possibilities in them, devil and angel, depending on how the times moved them. Like the seed that splits concrete, it was the appetite for life in them that made them so destructive. It was just everyone's misfortune to be born in times when the wherewithal for living had got so scarce. Well, it's a fact with me that I like people more the less I see of them. And after 2 days of thinking like this, I was almost ready to give the Reverend Boathwaite a hug. It may not seem it, but I have a soft heart. There's a streak of fond soil in me that Ping put roots into, and they tore me up when she went. I didn't see any game the first day, but by a stroke of luck I stumbled onto some caribou on the morning of the second. They weren't skittish, as you'd expect. In fact, when I held out my bare hand and yelled, "Mach, mach!" as though I had brought salt for them to lick, they came nosing up to find it. I knew from this they'd belonged to someone once. It seemed to me the best thing of all would be to bring them back alive. Though they came up close, they soon dropped back when they learned there was no salt to be had, and they were leery of being roped. I could have chased around all day and not caught a one of them, so I decided to work a little sideways. I dropped my pants and crouched down, shuffling a little in my boots, to spread the piss around in the snow. You can't keep caribou away from fresh piss. The heat and the salt in it is like apple pie to them. And while they were jostling each other to get to the freshest patches, I pulled up my pants and roped 6 of them. It still wasn't the easiest thing in the world to get them moving as a team. Every now and again, one or two would fix on a patch of lichen, and I would have to tether the others while I tried to shift them. Because I just wasn't strong enough to manhandle all 6. But it was gratifying to have gathered so much food, and I knew that with the hunger there was in Horeb, there would be nothing wasted, and they'd get eaten up, hooves and all. So we made our slow way back and arrived at the stockade toward late afternoon on the 3rd day. The gatekeeper slid open his spy hole and called for me to wait while he fetched the reverend. I greeted Bothwaite all friendly. Though I was tired, I was proud of my haul, and the hard work seemed to have got life flowing through me again. "I expect you'll be wanting these," I said, and waved my guns at him. He flinched, then saw I meant no harm, and smiled as he took them from me. They must have fallen on me just as soon as I entered the gate, though my recollection of it is not clear. There was a heavy blow on my shoulders, as though a branch had fallen on me, and a dull pain which made me sink to my knees. I couldn't tell you how many of them attacked me, or even what they used. The only face I remember belonged to the round-eyed boy I had met that first time in the woods, but now it was all snarled up with hate, and I could hear him screaming, "Traitor!" as he broke my arm with a club. I thought to myself, "So this is how it is," and curled up limp on the ground, since there was no way to fight all of them. But once I was down, the beating eased, and they dragged me by my feet into a lean-to by the wall of the stockade that was not much bigger than a doghouse. They gave me a few kicks as they squeezed me in, and I lashed back at them and called them foul names, saving my best expressions for the two-faced reverend. Then someone had the idea of throwing a bucket of water on me to shut me up. It was still afternoon, but the air was cold enough that my damp clothes seemed to leach out all the heat in my bones. Still, I kept cursing them through clenched blue lips, knowing that if I fell unconscious now, the cold might well finish me off. Luckily, the water had hit me at an angle, and enough of my body was dry to keep me alive. But when they finally pulled me out toward nightfall, I had ice in my hair, and I was shivering as though racked with a fever. Bothwaite and a few of the elders had set up chairs in the chapel. They sat me on a stool in the middle of them, lower than the others, and placed so I had to twist according to who was addressing me. My hands and feet had been tied with rawhide thongs hard enough to cut into the skin, and I had to half-hop, half-shuffle into their presence, and the break in my arm ached like hell every time I jarred it. The reverend had a somber face on him, and he told me he'd had no choice but to submit to the will of his flock in having me arrested. I asked what possible reason they had for thinking that this was fair dealing toward me, and one of the elders stood up in a rage and said what right had a deceitful bitch like me to expect fair dealing. I said he was very brave in threatening me, bound as I was, but I still had no idea what I might have done to earn this hatred from them. Bothwaite said they had a number of charges to examine against me, of which the most serious was spying, but that they were also concerned to find out for what reason I had tried to pass myself off as a man. I said I never passed myself off as anything, but that if people were minded to think of me as a man, I never felt the need to correct them. "Think of me as you like," I said. And the old man who had abused me before leaped up and said he would think of me as a deceitful, disfigured bitch. I could tell that Bothwaite thought that this was taking things too far, and he told the man to be seated. "What is more serious," he went on, "is that among your possessions we found certain notebooks written in cipher." "Show her the book, Dr. Pritchard." Dr. Pritchard was a ginger man of about 50 who had so far been silent, but who I recognized as being the man who had thrown the water on me. He held a battered old book about the size of a hymnal under my nose and opened it up. Its frayed pages were covered with letters or signs that had been inked by hand. Someone had taken great pains to write it. But it wasn't me, since I had never seen it before in my life, and I told them so.
Then how did it come to be among your possessions?
I said they ought to know that better than me, since they put it there.
Do you deny that this is your work?
I do, I said.
They seemed almost pleased with my answer, although they could have expected no other.
I said nothing more to them that evening, and they soon took me away to a cellar in another part of the stockade. For the most part of 2 weeks, they kept me in a cellar, fed me slops, and hauled me out for questioning at odd hours of the night or early morning. Dr. Pritchard was sometimes the questioner, and sometimes Boathwaite. Aside from the lack of sleep and the bad food, there was no terrible hardship. Each time they questioned me, they produced more fake books that they said I had been carrying, until it seemed they must have thought I was a traveling library. They asked me about all sorts of things, where I was from, why I was dressed as a man, about my face. I answered them as straight as I could. The bell went off in my head when they started talking about accomplices and mentioning names of people in Horeb who I had never even heard of. Jacob Vetch was one that came up over and over again, and when I said I didn't know him, they snorted and grew impatient with me. It turned out that I was the liar that time. They brought me in the next day, hooded, and told me that I would now meet Jacob Vetch face to face. They pulled off the hood, and I stood blinking in the light for a moment. There were more of them in the chapel this time. Boathwaite sat apart from us, making notes. Jacob Vetch sat slumped on a stool in front of them. Of course I'd met him before. He was the old man with the gun who had been guarding the woodcutters the first day I ever clapped eyes on Horeb. That wasn't the surprise. They had given him a proper working over. One of his ears was torn, and he had a raw stump for a thumb. It seemed like my coming had been a boon to Vetch's enemies. I've often wondered what the poor man had done to deserve such usage. I've seen enough cruelty to know it lights on the unlucky more often than the guilty. Horeb was a place staring into the twilight, as my city had been once. Those last days were the worst for us, too.
Boathwaite's eye met mine, and I felt a flash of understanding pass between us. Bill Evans used to call that the cold reading. He said that in detective work, sometimes the very best can slip into a man's skin and know everything that he knows, feel everything that he feels. It's hard to hate someone you've cold read. You see there's a reason behind their actions, and that even people with as much front as the Rev are split inside of themselves. In that moment, I could see that Boathwaite lived in fear of the people he led. Love and mercy wouldn't guarantee their obedience. They were disappointed and hungry. Boathwaite had to use the patterns of older gods to keep them cowed. Terror and mercy, like twin shadows of an old totem that gets fed with blood. Poor Vetch would die to terrify those half-starved people. And all of this I sensed Boathwaite knew as plain as I did. That look told me, too, that a part of Boathwaite held himself in contempt for what he'd sunk to. But it was no consolation to me. Something in him was of the utmost dark, and I knew he would want to stub me out for having seen it. They built a gallows that evening, and at dawn they marched us out. There were four of us. I don't know where they'd kept the other three, but they were in much worse shape than I was. Vetch's hand and ear had been patched up, but his face was grayer than boiled beef. Boathwaite said, as ringleader of a treasonous plot against the people of Horeb, he could expect no sympathy, but he was entitled to his last words. Vetch mumbled a prayer, and then they pushed him off the scaffold. The drop was too short, and he kicked until he strangled. Time slowed down as they came to me.
I must remember all of this, I thought. Odd thoughts were taking shape in my head. How strange to be hanged as a traitor. How strange to be hanged just when my broken arm was beginning to knit. Boathwaite said I had been found guilty of conspiring, too, and sentenced to death, and what did I have to say?
All their eyes were on me, waiting for me to speak, but no words came. I looked at their dingy clothes, and the colors of all of them that seemed like the colors of the earth that would swallow me up. That time at the lake, I hadn't been in my right mind. My brain was all mixed up as though I hadn't slept for a month, and the pain of leaving the world had seemed less sharp. But now, I felt sad. Even out here in the cold, 6 weeks at least away from spring, the sky still had some beauty in it, and the light on the melted ice looked moist and clear as a child's eye. There was a creak as Jacob Vetch's body twisted on the rope beside me.
With the practice I've had at last words, you'd think I'd be better at it. In fact, my intention was to face them out with silence and a look of loathing. But at the last moment, something blurted out my mouth that makes even less sense now that I've had all these years to think about it. "What you take from me is not mine," I said. And the pause stretched out afterward as they waited for something else. But I was wise enough to know that it would be even worse to add to it. "The death penalty has a biblical sanction," said Boathwaite. His voice was loud, and it had a hoarseness to it that grated like an ice saw. "For a long time our people preached against it, but Jesus came to fulfill the prophecies of his Father in the Old Testament. Jesus himself is God, and the one thing he cannot do is contradict himself. He never scrupled to punish with death the enemies of the Holy Spirit."
There was a muttered amen from the people.
Good night, Makepeace, I thought. I prepared for the push in the small of the back, the panic and the choking heat of blood in my throat. You have to lie back and breathe, I said to myself. I figured that submission would lessen the pain better than going tight and kicking.
"Even so," he said, "the blood of Jesus himself was spilled in mercy, and that mercy can in some instances countermand the sternness of chastisement. In this case, since the condemned is a female, we have decided to commute the sentence to one of indefinite servitude."
The Reverend liked to lard his talk with jaw-breaking words that were hardly English. But I understood that they were giving me a break for being a woman. It was the first time that things had ever shaken down like that for me. The landscape in front of my eyes began to fizz and bubble as they cut me down. I hadn't ever passed out in my life before, and I was damned if I would now, but my legs trailed on the ground behind me like a pair of limp sausages as they carried me back to the cell. They let me sit in the dark for days after the sentence was passed, because I told them my arm was still too damaged for heavy work. A few of them didn't like that, saying that my other arm looked good enough, and what was the point feeding a layabout and a traitor when plenty of honest people were going hungry? I managed an inward smile at that, because it reminded me of so many arguments we'd had at home about the incomers. I was told my rations would be cut until I made myself useful to them. They gave me moldy pickled cabbage the first day, and a chunk of bread. The bread was stale and heavy. I turned it over in my hand. It was the first I'd seen for a while. In its way, almost as much as the plain, that sour old crust gave me a jolt of hope. The summers had grown warmer in the north, but there was still no wheat planted at our latitude. So much of Horeb remained a mystery to me, but they had flour, and they must have been getting it from somewhere. The thought hadn't struck me before, but once I started turning it over in my mind, I saw other ways that those people were linked to a wider world. Bothwaite's letters, or whatever he'd been working on when I went to see him in his quarters. Even his suspicion of me and the fake conspiracy meant that in his head I fit into something larger and more populated than Horeb and the wilderness around it. Until it came staggering into the drugstore, I'd never given much of a thought to the world outside my town. Carlo, yes. He was buried in maps and atlases, and he had the tongue and memory for other languages. Me? I was an outdoors girl. I was restless and impulsive. The trees outside the city were the world, and the house was home, and the highway running east to west led I didn't care where. To say we were an inward-looking people was like saying that the Tungus found the reindeer useful, or that the Siberian winter could be chilly. My mother had grown up in a house that was warmed in winter and cooled in summer. But when she followed my father to settle this new world, she left all that behind. She wasn't the only one. Many people saw a kind of virtue in what was simple and homespun and patched, in the days before that became the only thing there was. My mother despaired sometimes that I was not a girly girl, not fair and curving like her, but tall and lean, with a chest as flat as Carlo's. I was like Dad, all angles, hard red elbows, and a big nose to cap it. She tried to interest me in household things, knitting and wicker work and caning chair seats, but without much luck. One gray spring day, when I was out of school with croup, she let me lie in their bed, the wrought iron one with brass balls at the corners that they'd brought with them from Chicago, and which had loose joints that made it jingle when you moved on it. I was scratchy and restless. I must have been 10 at the time. My mother brought me basins of hot water with lavender in it to ease my breathing. She took the lavender from a chest in her cupboard. She was so patient with my griping. "Here, Em," she said, which was as close as she had to a pet name for me. "I want to show you something, but you've got to swear not to tell your father." That immediately made me forget my sore throat. I think of her turning half out of the cupboard, her long fair hair almost at her waist, and some mischief in her eye, which if you knew my mother at all, you would hardly believe. Swear? That one word struck me as extraordinary. As Quakers, we were held to such a high standard of rectitude that to swear to anything was against our religion. We told the truth all the time, hand on the holy book or not, and to suggest otherwise was considered an attack on our dignity. "This is something for the two of us only. Understand?" I nodded, and she brought out of the cupboard the carved lacquer box that she kept the little vial of lavender oil in. She put the box down on the bedclothes and let me investigate it myself. It was a kind of Chinese design, round-shaped, with a big, carved wooden handle that stood proud of it. The handle was dark red and the lid black, and on it was a faint drawing in chipped gold paint of a man under a willow tree. The lid was worked on tight, and she had to help me to shunt it off. Thinking back, it must have been a sewing box because of its shape and the way it was built in layers. The topmost layer held ointments and dressings and little glass ampoules of medicine. I could tell that wasn't her reason for showing it to me. Her eyes had a sly laugh in them, and she was quick to help raise the tray and open the lower part of the box. My first feeling was one of disappointment, as the contents were drab. The first layer had had a touch of the forbidden about it, but this looked like what I cleaned out of my school desk at the end of each year. Pencil shavings, crumpled paper, elastic bands. "These are a few things from before I met your father," she said, and took one of the pieces of crumpled paper and set it in front of me. Inside it was a silver stone, about the size of an apple, but flatter and hard and cold. It lay there, dead and unresponsive. "Not working," she said. She took it out of the room and put it somewhere, then came back and we went through the other things in the box together. Trinkets, really. a leaving card, a lock of hair, a broken watch that she said had belonged to her father. Nothing that was really equal to the sense of mischief she'd brought to our conspiracy. I felt deflated and my throat was hurting again. She went out of the room and brought the stone back. "I just hope there's enough sun today," she said as she set it back down in front of me. It was warm to the touch now from having laid out in the sun, and on the skin of it you could see little shapes in light, like the outline of stars in the dark, but green. I was almost afraid to handle it. "Go ahead," said my mother. "It won't bite." I prodded it again, and the stone seemed to leap into life. A picture appeared on it, not flat and painted, but lit up on one whole side of it, and moving and speaking. It was of girls, 6 or 7 of them, and a bit drunk.
"We all think you're crazy," said one of them, "but we still love you."
Then one of them sang off-key. "The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man." And another said, "Not a preacher, dumbass, a Quaker." Then the picture froze and faded away. "It's a memory stone," my mother said.
"Who are they?"
"Friends from before."
"Before what?"
"Before I met your father." I don't think my mother was prepared for what that stone made her feel. She was curt with me afterward. I remember what the stone says so well because I used to go up and listen to it on my own sometimes. The stone was like no other object in our house, or our town for that matter. So flat and smooth, there was no workmanship in it. It was perfect, like a thing that had grown up from a seed. And yet, somehow, it held a piece of my mother's own past, a fragment of the life she had left behind her to come with my father. Those girls in the memory stone are all dead by now, and everything they had is dust. One of them has lipstick on that's smudged, and it looks like she's been kissing. I wonder about that kiss. Was it a he or a she? Is that him, standing just out of view but casting a shadow over the wine glasses and getting a sidelong glance from her, a twinkling look, right before the stone goes dark? I can't begin to contemplate everything that's been lost. It's too much for one small brain to take in, but I think about that kiss. Chapter 12. My parents never spoke of the past, and me, I never took much interest in it. The past had nothing to teach me. The beginning of the world and my birth seemed like the same event. For me, the world began with water dripping off wet sheets in the sunlight. I was the creator, blinking my eyes to make night and day. And I was Noah, arranging my chipped hardwood animals in the dust of the Arctic summer. I taught my family language, and I was the first human to set foot in the wilderness at the bottom of our vegetable patch. But now, I know different. I thought I was born into a young world which was aging before my eyes, but my family came here when the world was already old. I was born into the oldest world there was. It was a world like a beaten horse, limping with old injuries and set on throwing its rider. And my parents, who claimed to love plain workmanship and the clean, forthright language of the Bible, behind them was a world of memory stones and plains and cities of glass that they wanted to unknow. "There's plenty of things I'd like to unknow, but you can't fake innocence. Not knowing is one thing. Pretending not to know is deception." While me and Carlo and Anna were playing in the dirt like fools that think they found Eden, and the other settlers were congratulating themselves on having the foresight to land up in a perfect corner of our damaged planet, the world they left behind was unraveling. What arrogance made us think we were far enough to be safe? We didn't know it at first, when that first starving woman fell dead outside the grocery store, but it seemed like half the world was on the move. By the time I was 14, our city had close to doubled in size.